Welcome to Whiskey Cask, cask strength conversation featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 351 for January 7th, 2012. Support for Whiskey Cask comes from Redbreast Single Pot Still Irish Whiskey. Find out more at redbreastwhiskey.com and join the Stillhouse to get your own personalized whiskey journal. Coming up in a few minutes.
It's an exciting time for Irish whiskey. And really, you know, it's a great time to be a whiskey enthusiast who is interested in the Irish whiskey category.
Leo Phelan is the president of the Irish Whiskey Society in Dublin. It's a whiskey club with tastings each month and an online presence devoted to the history and traditions of Irish whiskey. Much more with Leo in a few minutes, along with the calendar of events, the comments of the week, and the What I'm Tasting This Week department. Let's start off with the news, though. Brought to you again during 2012 by our friends at Glenmorangie. Back in September, I reported on the release of Redbreast 12-year-old cask strength in Europe. Just got word this week that it'll be available in the U.S. starting next month. Also, Cooley has now released a pair of 18-year-olds in North America. The Kilbeggan 18 and Green Ore 18 single grain have both won awards in international competitions since their debuts in Europe. Meanwhile, I haven't mentioned Monkey Shoulder for a while. If you're not familiar with it, it's a blended malt from William Grant & Sons that uses malts from all three of the Grant distilleries, Glenfiddich, Balvenie, and Kininvie. You'll find it all over Europe, but Grant's has now announced plans to bring it to North America for the first time. It'll be available at first only in the Chicago area and the rest of Illinois, and will be available in Texas later this year. No word yet on plans for a nationwide rollout or a Canadian release yet. You'll find my tasting notes for all of these whiskeys on the WhiskeyCast website and the free apps for iPhone, iPad, and Android users. In other news, I reported last month on White & Mackay's 60% drop in profits during the last fiscal year as it moved away from bulk blended scotch sales for private label bottlings to focus on its premium Dalmore and Jura single malts and its eponymous blended scotch. That drop in profits, combined with sharp losses at VJ Malia's Kingfisher Airlines, has some analysts predicting that Malia will consider selling off White & Mackay to focus on his other businesses. Not so, say company officials. White & Mackay's bankers signed off on the change in focus when they restructured the financing on the company's outstanding debt, and there are no plans to put White & Mackay up for sale. Back in August, I mentioned a new Canadian whiskey that's been brought to market by members of California's legendary Sebastiani wine family. Masterson's Rye is named after Bat Masterson, the legendary lawman of the Old West. Got word this week that Masterson's will make its debut in Canada later this month at the Victoria Whiskey Festival in British Columbia. Of course, I'll be in Victoria the weekend of January 20th through the 22nd. More details coming up that weekend. It's been a fairly quiet week as we get the new year underway, but if you have news to share or rumors that need to be checked out and confirmed or debunked, let me know about it. My email address is comments@whiskeycast.com. The news is brought to you by Glenmorangie, and if you'd like to win a stay at one of the luxurious Mandarin Oriental hotels, visit Glenmorangie's Facebook page for more details. Glenmorangie, unnecessarily well-made. I'd like to thank everyone who entered the Villeroy & Bock Whiskey Trivia Contest. I'll announce the winner in a minute, but here are the correct answers. I wanted you to name the distillery managers or master distillers of five different distilleries. And looking at the entries, four of them were pretty easy. Bal Blair's manager is John McDonald. Bernheim is Heaven Hills Distillery in Louisville. And the father and son team of Parker and Craig Beam are the master distillers. I would have accepted either one. Russell Anderson is the manager at Highland Park. And, of course, John Campbell is Laphroaig's manager. That leaves Auchentoshan, and this is the one that tripped up a lot of people. Alistair McDonald is the current distillery manager. A lot of people answered Ian McCallum or Jeremy Stevens. Ian was the manager there a couple of years ago, and after serving as master blender is now the master of malts for Morrison Bowmore. Jeremy is the current master blender. And as I said, each of these managers was either mentioned or interviewed on WhiskeyCast during 2011. Alistair joined us in September during our coverage from Whiskey Live Paris. Gene Matthews from California was selected at random by the Villeroy & Box staff from all of the correct answers as the winner of a set of fine flavor nosing glasses and a decanter from Villeroy & Box. Congratulations, Gene, and thanks again to Villeroy & Boch for sponsoring our whiskey trivia contest. Villeroy & Boch, glasses worthy of your whiskey. Time now for the comments of the week, brought to you this time around by Johnny Walker. On New Year's Eve, I asked a question on the Facebook page. Name your final dram of 2011 and your first dram of 2012. Had a lot of great responses. Several community members picked one of the various Pappy Van Winkle bourbons to wind up the year. Aaron Barker picked three different whiskeys, the Benriach 12-year-old Herodotus Fumosus leading up to midnight, Aaron's Robert Burns single malt at the stroke of midnight, and Jefferson's Reserve 18-year-old bourbon to start 2012. Dan Signo emptied his final few ounces of Old Granddad Bonded, and Scott Hartig ended the old year with Redbreast 12-year-old and started the new year with Lang's Big Pete. Now, I have to admit my favorite response came from Grant Hicks, and here's what he posted verbatim. Final of 2011, Jack Daniel's Single Barrel Ducks Unlimited bottling inside the house, followed by Kisses from the Misses. First of 2012, Pritchard's double-barreled bourbon outside in the warm for winter weather, watching the flash of fireworks up and down the street. For those who haven't tried either, the first didn't taste at all like duck, and the second didn't have any lead shot. Well played, Grant. Thanks to everyone who shared their holiday drams with us. If you have something you'd like to share with whiskey lovers around the world, you can always post it on our Facebook page, or if you're not on Facebook, just email me. My address is comments@whiskeycast.com. The comments of the week are brought to you by Johnny Walker on the web at johnnywalker.com. Click the banner at the WhiskeyCast website to become a Whiskey Insider today. Let's check out the calendar of events now, brought to you for the fifth consecutive year by our friends at Laphroaig. The Kensington Wine Market in Calgary, Alberta will host a Glenmorangie tasting on January 12th. The final round of Universal Whiskey Experience Dalmore dinners are set for January 17th in San Francisco, the 18th in Los Angeles, and the 19th in Las Vegas. Of course, the Victoria Whiskey Festival is the weekend of January 20th through the 22nd in Victoria, British Columbia. The Whiskey Exchange will hold a Burns Night tasting at its Vinopolis store in London on January 25th. Looking ahead to February, Julio's Liquors in Westboro, Massachusetts will hold its annual Whiskey-A-Go-Go weekend from February 24th through the 26th. You'll find a full calendar of events at the WhiskeyCast website, and it's brought to you by Laphroaig. Take a virtual distillery tour at laphroaig.com, and while you're there, become a friend of Laphroaig and claim your own square foot of Islay.
WhiskeyCast, brought to you by Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. In conversation with Barry Crockett, master distiller, Redbreast single pot still Irish whiskey.
The pot still category is receiving so much attention nowadays. I think what we will see as time progresses is that the single pot still category will indeed resume its rightful place at the very top end of the whiskies of the world. And of course, this is only correct given that Irish whiskey has had world recognition for not just decades, but you could say for centuries. And Redbreast is at the forefront of that.
Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. Those in the know Redbreast.
Time now for WhiskeyCast In Depth. The last distillery in Dublin shut down around 1975 when Irish distillers moved production of Jameson from Bow Street to the new Middleton Distillery in County Cork. But Dublin just wouldn't be Dublin without Irish whiskey, and the members of the Irish Whiskey Society are keeping the spirit alive. Leo Phelan is the Society's president and joins me via Skype.
First of all, before we start talking about the renaissance in Irish single pot still whiskey, tell me about the Society. You guys basically came together out of a common love for Irish whiskey, right?
Yeah, well, that's correct, Mark. Yeah, we, as I say, formed in January 2009, and we had our first, let's say, formal tasting in around April 2009. So officially just going on to three years now. So like any society, the idea is to make whiskey accessible for people who are interested in whiskey at a kind of a reasonable price. Because, as you know, buying a single bottle of whiskey just to taste it is an expensive hobby. So,
oh, yeah.
Yeah. So we meet once a month, the last Thursday of the month in Brooks Hotel, and we've had quite a variety of tastings over the year. So it's not just Irish whiskey, it's kind of whiskies in general, with an emphasis on the Irish, naturally.
Now, you did a president's tasting recently for the society in which you talked about really the renaissance and the comeback of pot still whiskey. Tell me about it.
Well, yeah, I suppose as the current president of the society, I have the honor, let's say, at the end of each year to conduct basically my own tasting. So it's essentially I picked the lineup myself, and this year I decided that the team would be Irish pot still whiskey, a journey back in time. So for that event, I basically selected a number of special pot still whiskies, and really it was just to try and illustrate, the tradition behind Irish pot still whiskey. So we had a number of special whiskies on that day. We kicked off with the first single cask pot still whiskey that was produced exclusively for the Celtic Whiskey Shop, which was only as recently as 2009. And then prior to that, then we had the Jameson 15-year-old, it's got the green label limited edition, which was released in 1999. And I suppose what was significant about that bottle from a pot still perspective, it was the first pot still release with a Jameson label on for over 30 years. So, you know, as recently as, you know, a little over 10, 12 years ago, you know, pot still was quite a rare phenomenon. So going back from that, then we had some earlier examples. Then we had we were very lucky to have a bottle of the Dungourney 1964, a 30-year-old pot still.
Wow.
Which was a very special whiskey to have on the night, and not many of us had the opportunity of tasting that before. So again, you know, another reason to get together for a society to taste whiskeys like this.
Tell me more about the Dungourney, because that's one that a lot of people probably have never even heard about.
Well, the Dungourney, I suppose, has kind of a quirky little story. Basically, the myth behind this particular bottling is that in the early 90s, there were apparently Barry Crockett, or one of his colleagues in Middleton, was going around the warehouses, and they discovered a cask. We think it was a number of casks, but a cask at least, that wasn't on their inventory. So they investigated this cask, couldn't find any reference to it other than what was on the barrel. And it turned out to be a Middleton distilled whiskey from 1964. So they decided to bottle it specially, and they named it Dungourney after the River Dungourney, which Middleton gets some of their water supply from. So I suppose it's a legendary lost and rediscovered cask. And I suppose the other interesting thing about it, being from 1964, it predates the amalgamation of Irish distillers. So again, an example of a whiskey that was from the period when Middleton was run by the Cork Distilleries Company.
And this would have been from the old Middleton Distillery, not the new one.
Yeah, exactly. Obviously, the new Middleton Distillery was founded in 1975, so not quite new anymore, but we still call it the new Middleton Distillery. But the old Middleton Distillery, yes, had been there from the 1820s right up in continuous production till the mid-1970s. So, yes, a very rare example of a whiskey from the old Middleton Distillery. So, quite a treat.
What were the other whiskeys on the lineup that night?
Well, we had an unattributed whiskey, which basically was found in a warehouse in the UK, in Falkirk, Scotland, specifically exported to Germany. and bottled there. So again, we're not 100% sure, but it might be an old Tullamore or an old Kilbeggan. So we tried that. It was a 15-year-old. And then we went back to 1953, and we got to try another, say, legendary Irish whiskey, Old Cumber, 30-year-old pure pot still whiskey, which was bottled in the around 1983 from the remaining casks from the Cumber distillery, which were basically a spirit merchant from the north of Ireland in Portadown called James McCabe, basically scoured the old bonded warehouses to see was there any remaining stocks together. And he blended them together just to produce this. So it's at least 30 years old.
Wow.
Yeah. So again, a fascinating whiskey, beautiful on the nose, but quite delicate, quite brittle because of the age. But the nose certainly gave a hint as to how great this whiskey would have been in its day.
And shame to have seen it sort of fade away before you guys got to try it.
Yeah, I mean, basically, the beauty of this whiskey was really on the nose. The taste, you know, it was initially very nice, but then the wood started to kick in because of how old this whiskey was. So because it was a blend of casks, I'm sure there was some overly wooded casks in the blend. And then we finished off today with, I suppose, what you might call a curiosity.
As if the other ones weren't curiosities enough.
Exactly. Well, I mean, exactly, a special tasting in its own right. For most of the audience, it would have been, they would have not have tasted the majority of whiskies before. And so I had in my possession as a bottle of William Jameson, original Irish-American brand whiskey. And this is a post-prohibition whiskey, I suppose you'd describe it. It comes from the early days of post-prohibition, originally created around December 1934. And the Irish connection being it was 25% 20-year-old sherry cask pot still whiskey from the old Marylebone Lane distillery, which closed in the 1920s. And it was 75% 12-month-old, as far as we know, straight rye whiskey. The only hint we had on the label was that it was from Louisville, Kentucky. So a little bit of research. The National Distillers were the producers of this whiskey, and they only had two distilleries at the time in Louisville, Kentucky. They were the Watton Distillery and the Sunnybrook Distillery. So our best guess, I suppose, was that the straight rye component was from the Sunnybrook Distillery. So the whiskey actually was quite intact, an interesting nose. The only hint of pot still that we could get was from the nose, but distinctive rye taste coming through on the whiskey. Quite smooth because it was blended with the Irish, but the distinct taste of rye. So fascinating whiskey, really, to try.
Now, I can tell you that at this point, one of my listeners is paying a lot of really close attention to what you're saying. Because by coincidence, just a couple of weeks ago, Jeremy Chatan, one of our listeners, posted on our Facebook page a picture of a bottle of William Jameson and Company whiskey.
Yeah.
Because he was given it as a gift from his brother and wanted to know whether he should drink it or collect it and save it. And I had not heard about it before, so I did a little bit of research and was told that a bottle of this in good condition is probably worth several hundred euros to an Irish collector.
Yes.
In Ireland.
Certainly, yeah.
What would you do with a bottle of this if you had been given it as a gift? What would you recommend that he do with this bottle?
Well, I suppose it could be one of two bottles. Either it's this Irish-American brand or it's an original William Jameson Marylebone Lane distillery bottling. A 10-year-old is the one that he may be talking about.
I am looking at, yes, it's the 10-year-old. I'm looking at a photo of it now, a squarish bottle, yellow label, green cap.
Yeah, yeah. So As a collector myself, I'm two minds because I have a bottle of each of these styles of whiskies. Certainly will be drinkable, I would expect. I have opened other old whiskies, and in the main, if the cork is intact, the condition of the bottle is good, they are extremely drinkable. And in terms of style, I mean, what he has there is an extremely rare whiskey. And, you know, would fetch quite a sum of money in the collector's market. But that's the dilemma. Do you, you know, at some point a bottle has to be opened, you know. And for me, it's about opening the bottle on the right occasion. So whilst I collect, I also open bottles. So, but for those special rare bottles, I look for the special rare occasion. So really it's a weighing up the dollar value versus the experience of the moment. And for me,
absolutely.
Yeah. For me, there are special moments where you have to open special bottles.
So he really has a treasure here.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. The 10-year-old Jameson that he has is quite rare. I only know maybe of a half a dozen examples worldwide. So it is quite a rare bottle. And from a long closed distillery, the William Jameson Distillery from Marylebone Lane.
What can you tell us about that distillery? Because a lot of folks are familiar with the John Jameson Distillery, of course, but William Jameson is rather obscure and not really well known about by the average whiskey lover.
Absolutely, yeah. Essentially, whilst Jameson, the distillery that we know, John Jameson, that was founded in 1780, I think the Jameson family became associated with Jameson Distillery in 1800, and by 1810 they had full ownership of the Jameson Distillery. But John's brother William is the founder of the William Jameson Distillery. So you had a distillery in Bow Street, the John Jameson Distillery, and you also had a distillery in Marylebone Lane, the William Jameson Distillery. So you had two brothers in Dublin, essentially in competition, effectively, producing whiskey. So I suppose whiskey making was a family tradition. As you know, the Jamesons came from Alloa in Scotland. So both brothers were set up in business in Dublin. And, you know, the William Jameson Company wasn't as successful as the John Jameson Company. And in the 1890s, they amalgamated with two other distilleries to form the Dublin Distillery Company. And those two other distilleries were the George Rowe Distillery from Thomas Street and the Dublin Whiskey Distillery from Jones's Road. So the three companies amalgamated, but their fortunes didn't do well, you know, with the advent of Prohibition and all the changes that have been well described. Two of the three distilleries closed down in the mid-1920s. And then the company, they continued to sell their whiskey under individual labels, William Jameson, George Rowe, and DWD. But by the 1930s, the company was in financial difficulties. And essentially, it was being wound down over the next 10 years. And I'd say the final liquidation occurred in the mid-40s. So quite an interesting history. But again, an example of the demise of Irish whiskey at the time.
And this was fairly common throughout Ireland during Prohibition.
Absolutely, yeah. The number of distilleries, we say, at the turn of the century was approximately 20. But by the mid-1950s, it had dwindled down to about five or six. And then, yet again, by the time Irish distillers were formed and they took over Bushmills Distillery, there was only one whiskey company in Ireland which owned two distilleries. So that really, around the early to mid-70s, was the nadir, in some ways, of Irish whiskey. And it kind of leads on, I suppose, to the pot still story. And I suppose what is interesting about the pot still story is that Jameson launched their first blend in 1963 called Crested 10. And then they launched the modern-day Jameson. It was called Jameson Red Seal at the time in 1968. And this was This was at a time where they had been producing exclusively pot still whiskey right up to the early 60s, and only began to get into the blended market in a serious way in the mid to late 60s. And stocks were low, and the number of brands only amounted to about 15 brands of Irish whiskey at the time by, you know, early to mid 70s. And if you compare this then with what was happening in Scotland, where maybe there was only, it was the reverse situation, that the blended whiskey had been very strong, and maybe in the 1960s there was only about 30 single malts available, if you could find them. And then Glenfiddich came along in the early 70s and started to make single malt very popular. So at a time where single malt was growing, Irish pot still was waning. So that continued basically until, I suppose, the modern-day resurgence.
Give me your opinion on the whole resurgence of pot still, because we've seen over the last 5 to 10 years especially a complete growth in this industry to where it's probably, we haven't seen it in many, many years.
Yes, Mark. I mean, it's quite an interesting development. I suppose from a global perspective, you have the increased interest in whiskey and brown spirits. So I suppose that's the backdrop. And then in relation to Irish whiskey in particular, you know, the success of Jameson in the United States has certainly helped raise the profile of our Irish whiskey, and also the success of Cooley in terms of innovation and bringing a variety of styles to the market has all helped push the Irish whiskey category. So with that, I suppose, comes a greater awareness and a greater interest in the styles of whiskey, in particular the traditional styles like pure pot still. Now known as single pot still. But in terms of people who might have advocated for single pot still Irish whiskey, the likes of Jim Murray and Michael Jackson, and here in Ireland, people like Peter Mulryan, all whiskey writers and whiskey enthusiasts, would have, I suppose, been crying out for a bit more of the traditional styles. In the Irish case, I suppose we only had, continuously, we only had the Green Spot brand as the sole, let's say, flag carrier for the pot still style. Similarly, Redbreast, but that, even for Redbreast, there was an interruption in production in the early 80s. And it wasn't until December 1991 that Redbreast was reintroduced. So literally only 20 years ago, Redbreast was reintroduced into the Irish market. So they were the two pot still styles that were generally available. And then there was occasional releases like the Jameson 15 in 99. And I suppose the key release for a lot of whiskey fans really was the Maison du Whisky release of the Redbreast 15 in 2005. I think that might have changed things for the whiskey industry in Ireland. Whilst they may have been planning around pot still, I think the success of that particular whiskey certainly showed that pot still as a category could be a huge success. And it culminated, I suppose, with the big launch this year, back in May 2011, of the Midleton pot stills. So from having one release maybe every 5 years, we were a bit spoiled for choice this year, and having three completely new releases this year, along with two single casks. So five releases in 1 year, and you were lucky to get one release every 5 years previously. And that's not to mention as well the work that Cooley are doing as well in terms of reintroducing pot still, and they've just done some new make spirit in Cooley as well.
The old poteen spirit?
That's right, yeah. Coming out of the Riverstown Distillery, Cooley have produced a poteen style, single pot still whiskey. Essentially, it's single pot still new make, marketed under a poteen label, obviously, because it can't be marketed as whiskey until it's 3 years old. and but also in Kilbeggan, in their, I suppose, their craft or micro distillery in Kilbeggan, they're also making small batches of pot still, so which should, in I think, in the traditional style. And maybe just to explain briefly, the traditional style of pot still, the definition of pot still, I suppose, for those who don't know, it's made from a mash of malted and unmalted barley, basically germinated and ungerminated barley. And traditionally, there would have been some oats and other grains in the mix. So maybe 5%, 5 to 15% oats would have been in the blend or the mash bill. And the principal reason for the oats, apart from imparting some flavour, was that when you ground the barley, the unmalted barley, it was quite floury and dry. So the residue tended to clog up the washbacks. So the oat, the layer of oats acted as a kind of a sieve when you were draining the washbacks. So again, very practical application of the oats, but also impacted on the flavor.
And this is what really sets Irish pot still whiskey apart from Scotch whiskey, which, at least on the single malt side, is also in pot stills, but that use of the unmalted barley is what, and the oats is what sets it apart.
Yeah, I'd say the oats is only used in the traditional style. Most pot still is just a mixture of malted and unmalted barley. So while similar to single malt, in generally speaking, it uses all barley, but a proportion of it is unmalted. So the reason being is that kind of gives a more spicier kind of crackling flavor to the whiskey, I suppose. And the enzymes in the malted barley are used to help extract the sugars from the unmalted barley. And I suppose there are historic reasons for that. If you go back to the late 1600s, the malt tax was introduced. And then the laws at the time basically didn't allow for mixed grain distillation. And it was only in 1800 that the mixed grain distillation was, the law was repealed. But then the tax during the Napoleonic period basically went up about 225% between 1800 and 1804. So there was a huge incentive to move away from doing all malt distilling to using a combination of mixed grains, so oats, rye, unmalted barley and malted barley. And to such an extent, I'll give you one example of that. By 1828, there was about 84 or 5 distilleries operating in Ireland, and only 5 to 10 of those were actually distilling malt on its own. All the others were distilling a mixture of grains, presumably in the pot still style.
Interesting. I have to ask, as the leader of the Irish Whiskey Society, your thoughts on the recent move by Cooley to sell to Americans and not having any more, for lack of a better term, technically Irish-owned distilleries.
Well, I suppose technically that's correct, but probably only for a short period, because the micro distilling scene is starting to kick off here in Ireland. So there's a few projects in the pipeline. But yes, in terms of the majors, and Cooley's kind of in the middle, and that's, they're relatively small compared to the bigger players. But yes, we're losing an independent. Yes, that's correct. But I think John Teeling himself put it very well. He said, with the backing of a company like Beam, they could take Cooley to places in 10 years with their advertising muscle and their distribution muscle. That might take them 20 to 30 years on their own. So from the point of view of the overall category and the Cooley brands, I think it's a positive. And I suppose there's a bit of sentimentality that we're losing that kind of independent player from the Irish market. But from what I know of Beam, which is fairly limited, I understand they're whiskey people as well. So that would lead to a bit of reassurance and that the company's probably in the right hands.
Where do you see this category going over the next 5 to 10 years?
There's no doubt about that there's a huge resurgence of interest in Irish whiskey, but it still only represents about 3% of the market, up from about 2%. And despite all this massive growth that we've seen from Jameson, double-digit growth for the last 10 years, incredible success in the United States and other markets internationally. But I think the category has room to grow a lot more, and you can see that in terms of the investment that the companies are making in additional capacity, warehousing. So I think it's very positive for the category. It's a question, I would say, it'll be more a question of the supply meeting the demand for the next number of years. But I think the addition of the pot still element to it, I think broadens out the Irish whiskey category, as have Cooley done with their innovation with peated single malts, single grain whiskies. You know, it's an exciting time for Irish whiskey, and really, you know, it's a great time to be a whiskey enthusiast who is interested in the Irish whiskey category.
Let's talk about those micros for a second, because we haven't heard much at all about the micro distillers that are popping up. What can you tell us about what's happening along those lines in Ireland?
Well, most of them are kind of in the very initial phases. There's three that I'm reasonably confident will reach fruition, two in Dingle and one in Belfast. So in Dingle we have a brewer, a very new brewer called Dingle Brewery Company, and we understand that they plan to take from the brewing side, the beer brewing side, take some of their beer wort and distill that and to make white spirit and whiskey. And our understanding is that's due to start or has already started, you know, in early new year. Similarly, there's another beer company in Ireland called the Porterhouse Brewing Company. And they also were looking at a site in Dingle, and they are also have advanced plans to set up a distillery in Dingle. And the other one that we're aware of then is a gentleman called Peter Lavery, is a successful entrepreneur in the north of Ireland who owns the Danny Boy whiskey brand, and he also owns the Titanic whiskey brand. And he is planning to set up the Belfast Distillery Company and hopes to have distilling operations underway by, we think, 2013. So they are the projects that we're aware of. There might be one or two as well in the background that we're not fully aware of. But I suppose the other major change really is William Grant's then. Grant's bought Tullamore Dew, the Tullamore Dew brand from a company called CNC early last year. And we hope, I suppose we're hoping that they will actually go ahead and build a new distillery, which would be another fantastic endorsement, we'll say, of the Irish whiskey category.
I know we talked with some of the executives from Grant's a few weeks ago, and they're still debating that decision.
Yeah.
What have you heard about, well, those two micro distilleries in Dingle, those are not the big ones that we've heard, the big distillery in Dingle that we keep hearing the rumors about. What's the latest that you've heard on that?
Well, essentially, actually, the two distilleries, it's the latter one I was speaking about is, quote unquote, the bigger one in terms of the Porterhouse Company would be the company that they set up was the Dingle Distillery Company. And they're quite a large, they own quite a large chain of craft brew pubs in Ireland. And so they would have the financial know-how and muscle to build something that's, say, not just a craft, but, you know, a reasonably sized micro distillery. So we're still hopeful that they are proceeding with their plans. We believe they're still looking for a site in Dingle. And, you know, you hear various rumors and it's very hard to comment, but we did understand that they have done some tests, distillation in their premises in Dublin, I think with a gin still. But again, you know, until it happens, you're never quite sure what the outcome will be. But yeah, we're optimistic as whiskey enthusiasts that these projects will reach fruition. Certainly, they're beyond the planning stage and looking at issues like pre-production and things like that. You know, so we're optimistic that they will make it through to, say, full production, post-production. And hopefully in 3 to 5 years' time, we will see a new whiskey product in the market.
That would be a wonderful thing to be sure to see another new distillery open up.
Oh, absolutely. So, it is all good for the category. You know, it's good for the Irish economy, for tourism. It's good for the whiskey fans. You know, so it's an exciting period, as I said before, and something to really look forward to.
Thanks, Leo. And, of course, there's a link to the Society's website on the WhiskeyCast website. If you're ever in Dublin on the final Thursday of the month, you'll find Kindred Spirits at the Brooks Hotel. If you want to learn more about the history of Irish whiskey or you're planning a trip to Ireland, I'd also like to recommend Heidi Donnellan's excellent Irish Whiskey Trail website. There's also a link to that site at WhiskeyCast.com. Time now for the What I'm Tasting This Week department, and I'd like to welcome a new sponsor to WhiskeyCast. Belle Blair will be partnering with the Glenrothes to bring you my tasting notes during 2012, and I hope you'll join me in thanking our friends at Belle Blair for their support. Let's start off with a look at the Highland Park 1971 Orcadian Series bottling. I mentioned this one and the 1976 version a few weeks ago, but the Angels apparently mugged the whiskey ferry that was carrying my samples, and they drained the entire sample of 1971. Jerry Tosh at Highland Park was kind enough to send along replacements for both malts, especially since both sell for more than $3,000 a bottle. I had notes for the 1976 version back in episode 345. Meanwhile, the 1971 is bottled at 46.7% ABV. The nose has great notes of Christmas cake, black cherries, almonds, and a touch of smokiness. The taste is clove, honey, and cocoa with a hint of mangoes. And the finish is very long with good spicy notes and hints of raisins and plums. It's a great whiskey. I'm scoring the Highland Park 1971 Orcadian Series bottling a 95. Now, the Whiskey Exchange released a cask of 38-year-old Kleinleash under its Single Malts of Scotland label recently. It's bottled at 42.1% ABV. The nose has notes of caramel, honey, and a nice soft smokiness with hints of ginger. The taste has orange peel, clove, and honey notes with a touch of brown sugar underneath. And the finish is lingering and smooth with touches of clove and honey. Overall, a very well-balanced and smooth whiskey. I'm scoring the Whiskey Exchange's Single Malts of Scotland Kleinleash 38-year-old a 91. The What I'm Tasting This Week department is brought to you this time around by Belle Blair. Vintages aged to perfection on the web at belleblair.com. My tasting notes are available in the free WhiskeyCast apps for Android, iPhone, and iPad. The Apple edition is brought to you by our friends at the Glenrothes. They're also available at the WhiskeyCast website, along with links to our Facebook page and my Twitter feed, the calendar of events, the photo gallery, and a complete archive of past episodes. The address is WhiskeyCast.com. And my email address for questions and suggestions is comments@WhiskeyCast.com. I'd love to hear from you. Support for WhiskeyCast comes from Redbreast Single Pot Still Irish Whiskey. Find out more at redbreastwhiskey.com and join the Stillhouse to get your own personalized whiskey journal. WhiskeyCast is a production of Cask Strength Media, copyright 2012, and comes to you from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.